there's a lot of potential for people to do bad things with it. But I think that we're, you know, we're seeing an era where that's actually going to diminish, and we're going to see real use cases that really make our lives a lot easier.
Hi, I'm Wyatt.
And I'm
Grace.
And you're listening to Our Dad and your host of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Moore, and we're back with our Experts Corner interviews with experts from all around the world, and we sometimes bring in investors in the short-term rental world. Today, I'm super excited about this conversation. Before we hit record, I was telling Mr. Harvey Kesner, principal at the law office of Harvey Kesner PC and co-founder of Equitify. Harvey began his career at the SEC in Washington, D.C., and has since become a trusted partner to leaders across industries, helping them raise capital, expand markets, and navigate regulatory complexities. And as real estate investors, there's always money involved in these deals. And there's a lot of people who are interested in raising capital and doing it the right way and staying out of jail. And Harvey knows how to do that, what to do, what not to do. And so I'm excited about this conversation today. So Harvey, appreciate you joining me.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
Absolutely. And so I always like to, it says you spent some time at the SEC. So you were on the other side of that coin for a little while. Now you're helping investors kind of raise capital, do it the right way. Making sure that they check those, make sure the T's are crossed, the I's are dotted. But take me back to how long ago was that, and then what got you out of or wanting to get out of the SEC world and then into private practice?
Wow, you're really trying to get at how old I am.
Exactly. I love start with the background.
Listen, I went to law school in Washington, D.C., and I graduated. I did a JD MBA in finance. So my goal, my career path was really not to be a lawyer my whole life. I kind of got stuck doing it because it's fun and I meet a lot of good people and learn new stuff. And that's why I'm still doing it 40 years later. Graduated in 82, and I had the great fortune of being offered an opportunity to go work in Washington, D.C., at the Division of Corporation Finance at the SEC. That is the gold standard for corporate finance people. I learned an amazing amount there. I was reviewing the filings of companies going public, and you know, some of them, for example, I always say I reviewed the filing for WordPerfect. Remember when WordPerfect was going public? It lost the battle to Word, but you know, there were guys like Wilson Sonsini Law Firm, one of the biggest law firms in Silicon Valley today, and you know, Larry Sonsini used to call me. I'm 25 years old. He'd want me to clear his filing. You know, it was sort of like a great career builder, and the stuff you learn there and the exposure, it was career making. And so I worked there for 3 years, and then I started working at different law firms. You know, you can only work so long in government service before you kind of cap out in your job, unless you want to make it a lifetime career, which is not what I wanted to do. I was headed for investment banking always. But fortunately, I stuck to law because most of the guys I know that transferred from law to investment banking were unemployed after, you know, the one recession after another.
Right.
But I kind of stuck with the law side of it.
Awesome. And so when did you get into private practice, and when did you leave the SEC?
So I left the SEC about 85, 86.
Okay. And then started working with like a lot of, I know, different companies raising money, getting their filings correct. A lot of, in real estate, a lot of times we're doing private placements and private offerings. What you navigate all of those worlds, I'm assuming.
Yeah, all of the worlds are really, I'm agnostic as to industry. I will say when I started working at a big law firm in D.C., and then I got offered an opportunity to go work on Wall Street at a big law firm. You know, we're talking 800, 900 lawyers, international in scope, doing deals with the likes of Merck, you know, billion-dollar transactions, billion-dollar companies. And man, you learn so much doing that, that the work is so intense. And you know, unlike today where everyone's looking for a work-life balance, you know, work-life balance was, you know, you leave and get home by midnight and, you know, maybe you get back in the office at 8, you know, maybe. So that was the work-life balance then. But it was so intense and you work quite hard. And there really aren't that many people that hold you by the hand and baby you. You know, in the law world, it's kind of a rough and tumble world. You don't know something, you go ask the partner. They're like, go back to your office and figure it out. If I have to teach you it, I've got more problems than I need. So go figure it out. Yeah. And that's really the best way to learn this stuff. You have to go and figure it out, look at other models, look at samples, see what other people have done, and then you absorb that. And I've been absorbing that kind of stuff for, you know, 35, 40 years.
Which is awesome because you've seen industries change, technologies change, all that stuff, and regulations be changed, right? I was telling you before we hit record that I've always self-funded my deals. I've never done any sort of capital raises or put any sort of private placements together. And I'm in the process of one right now, a resort we're developing. And I've always been really, really nervous about it. People have asked me for a long time, why don't you, you could do so much bigger deals if you you've got a lot of people who are listening and following and doing things and would love to be a part of, deals with you. And I've always been nervous because I've seen from the sidelines, being in the real estate world for 26 years, you imagine the number of people that I've seen come and get in trouble because they've raised money the wrong way, or they've done things that they shouldn't have done or didn't disclose. Like we were talking before we hit record, you were saying it's not that hard to do it right. But it is intimidating to do. Like for me, I'm like looking from the outside, looking in, saying, I don't know if I want to run down that road. Like, and it was really expensive too, because of, you look into, putting some of these deals together and, you got these huge law bill or lawyer bills and putting the PPMs together and everything else. And I'm like, I don't know that I want to run down that road. What would you say to somebody like me that's like real nervous about it?
Well, I think before we started, I had a little quip. I said that, I see so many people doing it wrong, and it's easier to do it right. I mean, you just have to have some guidance from people that have, the depth of bench that have done it before that can guide you through it. We'll talk about expense in a second, but I often say that, the Securities Act of 1933 is where all this starts, right? And the Securities Act of 1933 is a disclosure-oriented statute. You have to disclose. If you have to think hard about whether you want to disclose it, the answer is disclose it, right? If you're thinking about should I, shouldn't, the answer is disclose it. And the process by which you decide what you're going to tell people teaches you a lot about yourself and about your own business. It makes you think about it. It's like due diligence. Sometimes due diligence is more important with what you learn about yourself than the actual function of what it is that you're collecting for the diligence file, right? You're learning more by the process than anything else. There are no real guidebooks. You can't buy the definitive textbook on how to take a company public, how to raise capital. There's a lot of books out there. You can go to Barnes & Noble and buy, lots of self-help books or The Idiot's Guide to. But there's a lot of folklore in what we do. There's a lot of we do it that way because, and it sounds silly, we've always done it that way. It's a touchy-feely thing. The SEC does promulgate, they do have very specific regulations that describe what it is that needs to be in disclosure documents, and that spills over into private raises as well as public raises. But it's generally stated like, give us a brief description of your business. Well, yeah, thanks very much. I could write 30 pages. I could write 5 pages. And it's the experience of having done it many, many times that tells you what the right notation is, what the right style is. Like I ask a client usually, okay, you write your description of business. Let me see it. And what they give me is marketing brochure. They're really telling me how they're selling products and who they're. And I'm like, no, that's not it. Let's take that 20 pages and make it 4. That's a brief description of your business. So there's a lot of folklore around it. You can't really look it up and be told exactly how to do it. And that's why I say to you, if you're going to go raise money and now no longer self-finance for this particular project, it's really good to have a partner at your side that has done it before 50 times. And it's no longer hard to them. They don't have to think about the questions that you would have. Should I say this? Should I say that? It's very nuanced and it's an art. It's not a science really in many respects.
And when you mention a partner, you're mentioning like, is it okay to have like if I'm in a situation, I'm like, okay, I know what we're doing on the development stuff. I've done this for 26 years. We feel really confident with that. I don't know like what partners you bring in, but when you're saying like hire like an attorney to help you put this stuff together, right? Then that's the that's what we're doing. But I'm like, is that what you're referring to? Or you're saying bring in a partner that's done these development deals before.
So
like we've done a lot of development deals is what I'm like kind of getting at. I've done a lot of the deals that we're doing. However, I've never raised money. You're saying bring somebody that's raised money or that's actually been in the game or hiring counsel to help you do this.
Sure. I think I'm saying all those things. I'm saying that it takes a team to do it. You need a good finance person to help you understand the financial dynamics and to write up the pro formas and the various things that you get disclosed in these things. You need a good writer. You know, you need someone who actually knows how to write well. And that's not necessarily a lawyer. In fact, most lawyers are horrible writers. And then you need a lawyer to kind of put the guardrails up and do sort of rule checks against what the SEC demands and say, hey, did the writer cover that? It's extraordinarily expensive to hire a lawyer to do the writing of these things. And often I get the non-lawyers to do the initial writing and I scale them back. And there are some very good writers out there that have either consult or they've done this themselves for their own businesses or they're, you know, hired guns that help people write these disclosure documents at a much, much more effective cost than having a lawyer do it. I mean, just to give you an example of the scale, New York City lawyers today, senior partners are $1,500 an hour and they don't apologize for it. There's no, I understand it's a lot. No, that is what it costs to hire, you know, New York lawyers that have done this before. Regionally, of course, it can get less expensive, but in my experience, and you know, I have to say I'm a bit of a snob, having worked mostly in New York City. Most of the capable, competent ones that have seen, you know, 50 deals for every three that someone else hasn't done are pretty much New York based because it's a money center. And now I do know there's a couple of good firms in Miami. There's good firms in Dallas. You know, there are good, certainly Silicon Valley, but you're mostly going to find the skill sets you need where there's banking, where there's financial resources, where there's capital formation, and not necessarily, in fact, probably the worst thing you could do is, you know, hire your uncle who knows a lawyer who does real estate deals, you know, who knows how to do dirt law, you know, and try to get them to translate that into raising capital. That's probably the worst thing you can do.
Right. What are some of the biggest mistakes you see people walk into when it comes to like putting deals together that you're like, man, that's going to get him in trouble?
I think over complexity. I think, you know, simple wins the day. The business model should reflect exactly what you're going to do, have a good use of proceeds in it, and not be overly ambitious, especially. Let me clarify. There's a distinction between the small cap, mid cap market and big companies, right? I mean, big companies that are worth billions of dollars are not what we're talking about here. We're really talking about project management. And in fact, it's funny, the definition of small cap, I think, is $200 million market cap and below. Yeah. To me, small cap is, you know, you're raising 20 million or 10 or 5 million, right. You're not raising 200 right. million, right?
Right.
So in that realm, I think you got to stay in your lane, stay very true to describing what it is, and keep your ambitions simple so that you can execute. And, you know, what's the old phrase, under promise and over deliver, you know, that's really what you want to do. Don't be saying, hey, you know, we're going to do, and I've seen this all the time, as have you, especially in real estate, you know, oh yeah, we're going to do 400,000 of revenue in 24, you know, 2.2 million in 25, 13 million in 26, 85 million in 20. Like, no, nobody really believes that. It's not real. I mean, do something that's more realistic and tell a story that is a real story.
Yeah. Okay. So one, like, and keeping it simple and really being able to articulate what you're going to do. I always say, you know, when I've talked about and I've had a lot of questions on, you know, about raising capital and how to use other people's money to do deals and everything else. And one of the big things I tell people, and I, you know, I don't know that you would disagree. If you do, please tell me. I always say, just be very, very careful before you run down the road of raising capital until you're an expert in what you're, the type of a deal that you're doing. Maybe that's true, maybe that's not. I always feel like there's a lot of responsibility when you're using other people's money. And I always steer a lot of investors, especially new investors, away from raising capital until they've got that experience, until they've done a few deals, until they really kind of become an expert in what they're trying to use other people's money for. And I don't see that all over the place. And I'm wondering if that, if you would agree or disagree with that piece of advice on the front end.
Well, I would say that taking other people's money, you take on a sacred responsibility. I mean, yeah. It is a very, very big ask to take, have somebody give them you their hard-earned money. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not, you know, 100 millionaires that'll write you a $500,000 check and not even think twice or ask any questions about it. But for the most part, that's not who we're raising capital from.
No.
And it may be the first and only private investment the person's ever done. And you have a very sacred duty to treat that person's money as if you were getting that money from your brother or your mother or your family. You know, you should treat it. You should be more cautious with it than even your own money. You know, that's one. Yeah. And you know, the second part of that is that there are many inexperienced people that still do really well, and there are many experienced people that fail. You know, the road to a successful business that returns everyone's capital and makes money is littered with great ambition and great ideas. I wouldn't say that experience is necessary to the success of a company. I'll tell you a little story, if you don't mind. One of my longtime law clients that I had taken public in his telecom company called me in 2018. He said, "Harv, I'm starting a drone company. I'm moving to Puerto Rico." And I'm like, "What do you know about drones?" And today his company's worth, traded on NASDAQ. I helped him get it public. It's worth $1.7 billion market cap. And it's the only U.S. Supplier of drones, small class one, these little ones, to the military that is really making any progress. You know, the whole drone industry was dominated by Chinese guys that had 97% market share or something like that. And he went out to attack that business. We made four or five acquisitions. Today, he's pushing a $2 billion market cap from absolutely nothing and knowing nothing. And, you know, we did raise money from people we didn't know to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a really good point to make. Yeah, there's people with a lot of experience that can screw up a deal, and there's people that are brand new that can do what really well. And so I think it is a good point. If I was a real estate guy and I called you and I said, "Harvey, I want you to help me put this together. I've got this big deal. I'm super excited about it. I've never really done this before, but I've, you know, read some books and I've hired some coaches and I'm ready to go raise some money." Would you tell me to get a partner that knows that game? Or would you say, "Hey, listen, it looks good to me and let's put this together"? And that's where I try to lean people is like, "Hey, listen, you're, if you've never done it before, you've got to have somebody or somebody on the team or something that shows that, hey, this is actually viable." Because I think there's a lot of things that look good on paper, and you can disclose all the disclosures and everything else and still make it look really good on paper. And you might not even know that what you're putting down has zero chance of working.
No, I think 100% you need someone who knows the ecosystem in which you're going to play. I mean, if you're going out and just learning something new for the first time, versus having a partner with you that's helping guide you, even if it's a board level, you know, advisor or someone you have lunch with, the most important thing is that the ethics and the morals of the person are such that they bring to the table skills and experience that are going to be valuable to you. And they're going to do with your money what it is that they said they were going to do with it. People don't mind necessarily losing money as long as the investment they made was with someone who did what they said and was honest and forthright and communicated with them. I mean, communication is a very big factor in this too, as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I would agree with that. I know that in my world of real estate, I see a lot of deals that come across my desk and that say, "Hey, this is the best thing since sliced bread. This is going to make all kinds of money. Look at this." And we look at the underwriting. We're like, "Nah, you're missing a few things in there." And so I think that's, but on paper, it looks really good for somebody that wouldn't be as experienced. Maybe the person that's given the money, they wouldn't be able to read that as well as somebody that is in the game. And that's where I say, like, yeah, no, kind of at least try to know what you're doing before you start using other people's money. When you go to you know, and consider raising money. There's a lot of options, right? And it's like, hey, some things I've got to register for, some things I don't need to as much, some things I got to register for, but I can go for, you know, accredited investors only. And then there's crowdfunding and I can take non-accredited investors. Do you ever like tell somebody one is better than the other? Or it doesn't really matter. Is it very deal specific on what they're trying to do?
That's a great question. And the SEC and Congress have not made it any easier to sort through this. Let me try to unpack it for you. Okay. Yeah. It's a little like taxes. The IRS and the government says you're taxed on any income you make, regardless of the source, wheresoever you earn it, right? I mean, whatever it is, it's income. You've got to declare it and pay it. If you earned it in Ireland, or it was consulting fees, or it was a discount on buying a house, it's income, you know, things like that. So the securities laws are similar. They basically say, unless registered or an exemption is available, unless an exemption is available, everything has to be registered. Okay. So we start with looking at what the exemptions are. And there are a lot of them. The vast majority of things that get funded, to the tune of trillions of dollars, I have some of these statistics up on our Quitify site, to the tune of trillions of dollars every year is put into private offerings, things that don't have to be registered with the SEC. Now, the nature of the exemptions vary, and they vary over time, and they vary depending on the public sentiment. So, for example, I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But the vast majority of capital raising is done, you know, the same way you would raise money if you wanted to open a deli on 49th Street. You know, it's your friends and family and people that trust you or want to eat there for free. You know, they're going to give you the money. The registered offerings is the world of what we do in the law firms, where there's a very precise process by which you have to make these disclosures, file with the SEC, get someone like me who used to work there to read it, give you comments. And it's a, you know, it's an excruciatingly 15 month process before you can raise money from the public. But this is where the nomenclature really gets confusing. We call public offerings because you can advertise them. Yeah. Everything else is called a private placement, right? I mean, you're familiar with that distinction. But the reality is, since 2012, when the Jobs Act was passed, private placements don't need to be private anymore. So you may see a bus go by, or you may get a phone call, or you may get an email blast that says, you know, guaranteed 15% return on capital, you know, year over year, ROFR, you know, all these phrases. And I'm getting solicitations all the time. How is that not a public offering in what we call a private placement? So what happened in 2012-13 is that the Congress and the SEC adopted rules and laws called the Jobs Act. And the intention of the Jobs Act was to open up investing to smaller investors, not institutional guys, not private equity people, not family offices, but you and me, you know. And why would Congress want to do that? Well, Congress would want to do that because the valuations implicit in a private, so-called private placement, are far lower than the valuations of a company that's public. How do you value a real estate play? Discounted cash flow, right? It's like, what's my discounted cash flow? What's my discount rate? Boom, it's worth that. But if that same company was put into a public company, you would say, oh, what are the other public companies that they're like? What are their comps? What are their comparables? Oh, they trade on a multiple of, you know, 16 times revenue, or, you know, 22 times trailing earnings. And now that the only difference between those two entities is that one has liquidity for investors and the other doesn't. So shareholders in the public company can sell, and all of a sudden you get what I call a private to public arbitrage in value. So even though that's a little off topic, I want to put that in as background to kind of unpack, because since the Jobs Act, the opportunity for investing in what we call private offerings have been opened up to far more than just the guys that Sean knows and, you know, your guys, your friends at the club. You know, it's just not, it's now you can do what's called a general solicitation, which before that was reserved only for public offerings registered with the SEC in a private placement. And that's what allows you to see bus ads and get radio ads and television ads for things that are still not registered with the SEC. Now, that's a little bit of the Wild West because the specific reviewers at the SEC are not looking at your disclosure documents. That's on your shoulders to get it right. You know, as we started the conversation about what goes in these things is a little touchy feeling. It's art, not science. And what Equitify is doing is our company is we're allowing a much wider audience of investors to have exposure to these deals and get these pre-IPO valuations, hoping for that company to go public, allowing, you know, regular Joes to be able to put $1,000 to work. Whereas before, if Joe didn't know Sean, he'd never have that opportunity. So yeah. I'm trying to unpack the concept that we shouldn't be calling them private placements anymore. We should be calling them limited offerings or you know, restricted or unrestricted. You know, it's sort of a dynamic. The nomenclature hasn't changed in 15 years, but the nature of what's done has changed. And it massively allows more people entry into the pre-IPO valuations, hoping for that big hit when the company goes public.
So as an investor, which, yeah, and that's my understanding of it as well. It's like, hey, listen, we're going to open up these deals that sometimes are really good deals that have only been reserved for institutional investors, accredited investors, bigger, you know, family offices, like you mentioned, to the average everyday investor, the Main Street investor, and allow them to come in at a lower price point. Is the big difference then the difference between being liquid versus illiquid, because all of these would be more considered illiquid because there's not a marketplace to go sell them on, right?
That's correct. The big distinction and the big private value to public value arbitrage occurs only because that private company that's not currently on NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange or Amex has become liquid. And now people will give a premium knowing that if they lost their job, if, you know, the economy went bad, or if they had to sell their house, they can sell that stock on the market the next day and turn it into money. Whereas in a private company, I've got to call the founders up. Do you know anybody who might want to buy it? And then they'll give you a big haircut. You know, maybe you'll get your money back. Maybe you won't. It's not, it's really purely the liquidity differentiator. It's really nothing more.
Yeah. And the responsibility lies on the shoulder of the capital raiser, who is on the disclosures and everything else. Nobody's like in a public offering, the SEC is looking over it for you. You're sending it to them and they're coming back and saying, yeah, we like this, we don't like this, change that. In these other situations, it's the capital raiser who has to make sure it's right if they're going to run down that road.
Yeah, well, that's correct. It's always the capital raiser, even in the case of an SEC review document, because at the end of the day, and I laugh about this all the time, I was a 27-year-old who had no experience with anything, never raised money. I was barely making enough money to pay for my 2-bedroom condo in D.C. And I'm giving comments on, you know, deals raising hundreds of millions of dollars in a world that I had only the most superficial knowledge of from school, you know. So, you know, it's still on your shoulders to get it right, not the examiners at the SEC.
Yeah. And so as you fast forward through the years and AI is now available and AI is out there to help us, you know, do almost everything. How has that changed the game? Even from, you know, your law office, you know, I'm sure a lot of people are using, you know, Grok and ChatGPT and Claude as their attorneys nowadays. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on the right way to use that and the wrong ways to rely on it.
So I'm kind of new to this and I've been become very enamored with it. So I don't know, you know, if you started using ChatGPT 2 years ago, you're probably an early adopter. A year ago is probably considered a long time. I started toying around with it 9 months ago or so, and I started asking technical legal questions. And the answers were shockingly accurate and instantaneous. I mean, yeah, if I wanted to look it up, I would trace through the rules, regulations, I'd find it. It would take me a couple of hours. The answers I got on SEC exemptions were within a matter of seconds, and they were mostly 100% right. I mean, yeah. It's a little scary. I went to make a gift for a friend of mine, and I went to the ChatGPT, and I paid for the upgrade. And then I said, I want to make a poster that has this, that shows this stock price, that shows this valuation on this date, that says this. In an hour, I got a complete graphic design suitable for framing that was absolutely perfect. And I think that says a lot about where it's going. I mean, people have been saying that, you know, our lawyers are going to be relatively unnecessary. I don't necessarily agree with that, because I think that, coming back to what I said a little earlier, this is a lot of art, not science. And I think AI loses the art part and kind of gets the precision of what it's ingesting and feeds it back to you. And there are gray areas between what it's ingested and what needs to be done. That is still the province of a person, but I don't know that that's always going to be the case. And there was a very funny story in litigation this year where some lawyer had AI write a brief, and it cited fictional cases. I mean, it just made up cases and cited them. And the court really admonished the lawyers that had not done any of the checking.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're
Yeah. And that's where I think it gets, you know, scary. It's scary good. A lot of times I did the same thing with real estate deals. I look and ask it questions and different things I know about deals, and man, the information you get back is really good. I mean, it really is, for the most part, very accurate. But you know, that 2% of the time or 5% of the time it's wrong. You need that person that has the experience of looking over and say, yeah, this is right. This is, like, you need to really make sure it's correct. But I think, and I'm curious if you would agree with this, does it save us money as investors to start there and get those questions answered, get the things that, like, what do I need to do here? What are the check boxes I need to make sure that are taken care of? What do I need to have in my disclosures? And like you said, you're going to pay a lot of money if you have a high priced attorney write everything for you, and where you can take it mostly done and have it reviewed instead of completely written from scratch. Do attorneys, and like, do you guys like that, where somebody's bringing you something that was maybe generated with AI and said, hey, listen, I wanted to save myself some money. I did it this way. I asked these questions. Here's what we're doing, but I need to make sure that it's actually correct. Like, I need somebody to make sure the T's are crossed, the I's are dotted. Is that a viable use of AI, in your opinion, from the law firm side of it?
Well, it hasn't happened to me yet where somebody's brought me something that was made by AI. And I will also say that I've read a couple of press releases that people put together. It was very obvious to me that yeah. They were written by AI. It was close, but it just wasn't right, you know? And mm-hmm. So I think that, I don't know. I mean, the jury's out. I don't know if somebody could get a PPM written by giving the AI the tools it needs to give you the first draft. I don't mind ever getting a first draft. I mean, maybe I'm different from somebody other than a lawyer. Maybe I'm different than a lot of lawyers. I have a very soft spot for the issuer, you know, the guys like you, entrepreneurial, starting businesses, pursuing their dreams. So I'm known to say, worry about your payroll first. You can handle the legal fees when you have the money, you know, but that's not everybody, you know, yeah. But that's how I built my practice and my relationships. And, you know, I have lifetime relationships with career people in my career, you know, that I've built my career around that I'm in touch with and, you know, I've done their deals for 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah. Well, and it's awesome. I mean, you're right. Not everybody's like that by any stretch of the world. And so what do you think the future is as the line has kind of gotten blurred between public offerings and public solicitation and everything else and really having to register to do all that stuff, to now pretty much anybody can kind of go, you know, register stuff and go raise money. Do you think that that's going to make it continue to be the wild, wild west? Do you think there's going to be more regulations around that? Do you think more people start getting in trouble because the SEC is looking at it saying, I don't know that we really like this this box that we opened up.
Yeah, I don't think anyone understands it yet. I mean, I think they're just barely grasping crypto now, and that's been around, 5, 8, 10 years. I think AI isn't even really understood yet. How do you know when you're on the phone with a customer service person if they're a real person today? It's good enough that I can't always tell,
Yeah.
We're working on a development in our platform where somebody could come on our platform and be able to actually speak to an AI and say, hey, which offering are you interested in today? And they could say, hey, I'm interested in XYZ offering. Okay, would you like to learn more about it? Let me tell you a little about it. Well, how much would you like to subscribe? Well, give us your name and address and phone number. Well, how would you like to pay? We're trying to make it fully interactive with AI. I'm not sure the regulators are going to love that, because who do you blame when something goes wrong? Did the AI make a mistake, or a person that programmed it? Where's the accountability for it? So I'm not sure they're really ready to even assess what that means yet.
No, it's going to be very, very interesting watching it. And I think that it continues to add to that kind of the trust recession we have as consumers, right? Because we know that there's some really good technology out there that we can't always tell whether it's a real person or AI or chatbots or whatever else. We used to know that used to be pretty obvious when it was a chatbot or when it was something that was just, sending me out answers. Now it's pretty hard to tell, and people can get on these machines are able to get on the phone. They sound like a real person. They can answer in real time. And it's going to be very interesting to watch that. Especially as it pertains to some of these, intricacies of giving advice on investments and the regulations that all go with it. That, and I think that we're definitely still in the wild, wild west there to figure out how that's going to all shake out.
No, I agree with you. I mean, when it comes to making recommendations on investments, that's a very slippery slope.
Yeah.
It's give them the facts, let them make their own decision. But if someone calls you up and says, hey, man, I got the next hot deal, it's going to the moon, it's a 10 bagger, just hang up the phone, move on. No one should be making those kinds of representations.
Yeah. I was listening to a podcast this morning, and it was somebody talking about a new platform that they built that it's replacing certified financial planners to help give. You load in all your information, you load in your assets, your liabilities, you put everything you can financially in, and then it gives you an investment plan and recommends things. I'm thinking, when I was listening to it, I was thinking the exact same thing. I said, man alive, I can't imagine having a machine give investment advice, and then ultimately who's going to be responsible for all that?
So, I mean, that's a great segue, because I know you have a little bit of interest in talking about crypto, and I can use that as a good jumping point if that's okay.
Yeah.
The government view on crypto has changed 180 degrees in the last administration. I mean, from everything is bad to everything is good. And this is kind of on that point, because the way that tokens are created, there's no person, there's no management, there's no board of directors. There's a foundation in Singapore, and it does a token drop, and it gives it to people, and then the allocation of value is among those people. The definition of a security that the SEC had honed in on was called the Howey test. I don't know if you've heard about this or read about it, but the definition really is giving someone else money with the expectation that their skills will create a profit for you. And so the SEC kind of latched onto that and going after every crypto offering, every coin, they call them ICOs, as the illegal sale of securities, because, as we mentioned before, they were unregistered and there was no exemption available. They were giving them out to tens of thousands of people. And, they begin trading on a marketplace. And the expectation to make money on it is really from the increase in the value that's based upon what? I'm not sure what, just the supply and demand. Hey, I have to have it, but what does it do? I don't know what it does. Everyone else has it. I have to have it. So everyone was the use cases really hadn't evolved yet. The creation of the coin was from what we called a foundation, which is almost like a non-stock U.S. trust of some sort. There's no board of directors. There's no management. It's software. The software creates the coin and manages its processing. And, you know, you have computers that are solving algorithmic problems to generate more of the coin. And if there is something illegal about it, who do you go after? Except, you know, in these big notorious cases. Today, everyone says, hey, you know what? That's really not a security. It's something else. It's a computer program. And we shouldn't regulate it in the realm of securities. We should look at it as a value proposition that can remove friction in banking and commerce and create use cases around, you know, building valid projects around using ETH on chain to be able to transact value. I mean, why in the world should it still cost $25 to send a wire? You know, even if I send a $25 wire, it's another $25. That makes no sense, right? And the world of payments and stable coins can really solve all that and have instantaneous clearance and settlement. So I'm pretty bullish about it. I still think there's a lot of potential for people to do bad things with it. But I think that we're seeing an era where that's actually going to diminish, and we're going to see real use cases that really make our lives a lot easier. Just the way we're talking about AI becoming transcendental to the commerce and to the things we build and create.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's here to stay. We're going to see some good and some bad happen. We're going to see some things as always, when things are getting figured out, both with AI and crypto and all those markets and the new kind of those new economies that are really formed now. I've never been an early adopter of all that stuff. Like I'm definitely one of those, like, wait to see what happens before I dive in. It's a very interesting world that I think is here to stay for sure.
Yeah, and I'm working with some crypto treasury companies now. I mean, instead of putting the money in 4% returning money markets, people are putting their money into cryptocurrencies. And there's been hundreds of millions of dollars, even more than that, that have flown into companies that their whole change in model and scale today is, I'm just going to buy crypto and hold it as a treasury and see if it goes up. And there are good days and bad days. It hasn't been proven to be a success yet, but there's no shortage of money wanting to pursue those plays.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you said, the jury's still out on a lot of that, but it's definitely, you hear more and more stories of it being used as a store of value instead of putting money in banks, right? And saying, hey, listen, I think that I can, you know, maybe make a little bit of money here and put that money in somewhere that's not that 4% high yield savings account that might do a little bit better than that. And, you know, like you said, the jury's out, we'll see how that works. And, as things kind of, I think there's going to be regulations, hitting some of that stuff. I mean, where it's a fairly unregulated marketplace, both AI and crypto. I think that, you know, a lot of people are, anti-regulation, but I think that there are needs for certain things and checkpoints to be in place for both of those, because I think some bad things can happen too if it's just continues to always be the Wild West.
I thoroughly agree. I think you're 100% right.
Awesome. Well, Harvey, this has been a great conversation, man. I really appreciate it. I could kind of pick your brain for a long time. I'm sure a lot of people could. And so if people want more information from you, to get more from you where should we point people? You've got a few different places, but where should we point people?
Yeah, I think Harvey at H. Kestner Law, my website, my email is probably the best place. I'm there all the time and I respond pretty quickly. So, really great conversation. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Likewise, for sure. This is fascinating to me from the outside, always just being in the real estate world, seeing people raise money, but also now kind of diving into that game myself and starting to understand it a little bit more and trying to navigate those waters. And so, very much appreciate the conversation as well. You guys are listening. We'll post to Harvey's email in the show notes, so you know where to find him and can reach out to him if you want to continue this conversation. Maybe you have more questions. Maybe you want to dive into some of the things that he's got going and some of the with the software, Equitify, and with the law firm and everything else. You know where to where to find it. We always appreciate our listeners supporting our guests. It means a lot for us to support the guests that come on here. You guys that listen, we know how valuable your time is. We appreciate you spending it with us. And we always thank you for that. And you guys know that we don't run ads or sponsorships on this show. And so you didn't have to listen to a whole bunch of commercials while you're listening to this conversation. So the only way this thing grows is if you guys share it. And if you got any value out of it, share it with somebody else that you think might be like to have, be a part of these conversations. If you have more than 30 seconds, like it or review it on whatever platform you're watching or listening on. And the final, most important thing I ask you at the end of every episode, pick that one thing you can do today to start building that life you don't want to take a vacation from. Cheers, my friends.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution podcast. Share this with other people you think need to hear about it. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Hey Grace, is there a website? Yes! For more amazing content and expert advice, visit Vodacy.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.